So when it's time for you to begin, you'll see the green sign saying start. When you have 5 minutes to go, you'll see a yellow sign letting you know that as well. And then when you have time to stop, you'll see a red sign that says stop. And I will help you keep track of that red sign and won't let you go much beyond it unless a justice has asked you a question, and then you always may finish asking the question, even though the red light is up, but I won't let you wander into other things. So with those brief announcements, I see Attorney Owens, you're still muted, so you're gonna wanna take that off because you're gonna be the first person up today.
I believe I'm unmuted.
Very good. Okay. And are you prepared to proceed?
I am prepared to proceed, Your Honor. Yes.
Please do.
Good morning, Chief Justice Rogenczak, Associate Justices. My name is Joseph Owens. I am the attorney of record for the defendant and appellant and petitioner, Ismet Islami, in these proceedings. My co-counsel is Deborah K. Rydell, and she is not going to orally argue today. However, she is on the brief and was on all the levels of the brief in this case, even in the trial courts. So this case presents issues relating to marital interests, contracts, and property, the domestic abuse public policy statute, and also, we'll call it common law issues of conflicting contractual provisions in insurance contracts. Those are the three big issues. And if we group them in Roman numerals, I would say Roman one is, what about this issue of marriage, remarriage, and the importance or the legal effect of a judgment of legal separation? And this has been a great deal of discussion, as engendering of a lot of discussion in the family court area. I will say that the net result of my discussions with everyone was that there is a way to harmonize the provisions of Chapter 766, the Marital Property Act, which defines dissolution of the marriage as occurring by divorce, annulment, or judgment of legal separation, and the provisions in 767 and 765. 765 is entitled marriage, and 767 is actions affecting the family. Those two deal with the issue of the impediment to remarry if one has not yet been divorced. There is a confusion until you think it through. Marriage, remarriage, and marital status are different things. We know that the Marital Property Act, which went into effect on January 1 of 1986, postdated Chapter 767, the no-fault divorce law, which was in the late 70s. So they were never directly harmonized, but we walk through it. If a person gets a divorce, those of you who have sat on the marital and divorce bench know about the last thing you say to the divorcing parties is, I have to tell you that you can't remarry anywhere in the world for 6 months from today's date. You are divorced as of today's date, but you may not remarry for 6 months here or anywhere else in the world, or that marriage will be void. That has its genesis in both 767, which is 767-35 sub 3, and it refers you back to 765-03 sub 2, who shall not marry. And that is, it's unlawful for any person who has been a party to an action for divorce in this state or elsewhere to marry again until 6 months after the divorce judgment is granted. And again, granted is banging the gavel in the courtroom, not entry of the judgment.
Mr. Owens, let me ask you a question. Do you think that if we are able to decide this case based on the issue of domestic abuse, that we need to get to the issue of whether or not these parties were married under the terms of the insurance policy? Which is to say, let me ask it a little better. Okay. If we answer the domestic violence question, is that dispositive?
It could be dispositive because it doesn't matter whether the parties are married or not if they're in some kind of intimate described relationship.
Right. Under 968.075, had they been married, that's enough under that definition, right?
Certainly. And yes, correct. So you probably are there with that. However,
so let me just ask a follow-up question then. In reading Kemper's brief, I think one of the issues that they talk about quite a bit is this meaning of imminent, how it's defined under 968.075. And I believe, and Mr. Frederick should, of course, have an opportunity to speak to this, but in reading the brief, it seems to me that they're really arguing that the word imminent means immediate. And I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that. What should the definition, how should we define that word of imminent in the statute?
We should use the Black's Law Dictionary definition that I found very important. This fourth edition one that said, cited in my brief, that said, imminent is immediate, not immediate. It is pending. It is apprehended. I thought that very interesting to use the word immediate rather than immediate. And they specifically are using that to show that that word does not mean instantaneous or in the immediate, which was the argument by Kemper, that it is immediate. And Black's Law Dictionary defines it differently. The fact that the drafters used a word other than immediate, they used imminent. And imminent is not immediate. It's pending. It's a foreshadowing of a fear of something in the future. That is my response to your question, Justice.
Thank you.
Counsel, since we have pivoted a bit to talk about the domestic abuse definition and the interplay of Section 631.95, I have a question for you that relates to the definition of domestic abuse. The legislature chose to utilize, for purposes of 631.95, the definition of domestic abuse given in 968.075. But there is another definition in our statutes, specifically the Domestic Abuse Restraining Orders and Injunctions Statute, Section 813.12 sub 1 sub AM, includes damage to property in the definition of domestic violence. That is not included in Section 968.075. So as we're construing the statutes, how would you apply that? Because the legislature presumably chose the definition of domestic abuse that it wanted to use for purposes of Section 631.95. And there's no reference to property damage in that definition, which is found in 968.075.
That is correct. 968.075 does not refer to property damage, which must be unusual, seeing that the whole thrust is prohibiting enforcement of property loss exclusions for intentional damage to the property. It's interesting and hard to explain, although if one were to use the abuse definition under 813.12, as you stated, that would encompass specifically criminal damage to property, as you know. The oddity is that the statute refers us to the Children's Code at 48, at 48021, and then when that sends you over to provisions in 4802 sub 1 that are about physical sexual injury to children, prostitution of children, showing them terrible movies of sexual exploitation, or drug, exposing them to drug manufacture and dealing. It doesn't seem to make sense that one would refer to 813.122, which is the child abuse statute definition, when you track it through. What does make sense, and maybe it was a Scrivener's error, it should have been 813.12, as you stated, and that has the criminal damage of property in it as one of the triggering items. I can't explain why you would be using all of these children abuse definitions, which have nothing to do with property or insurance or anything. It just doesn't make sense. I think it's a Scrivener's error.
Can I follow up, Justice Karofsky? I'm sorry, I wasn't done yet with my line. If you could wait a moment. I'm struggling with it too, counsel, because I think, you know, a lot of people objectively and because Wisconsin law does recognize property damage, and here we're talking about a woman's house having been burned to the ground and losing all of her possessions, I think many people would say that's absolutely domestic abuse, but we have to apply the statutes as they are written, and that is not the statutory definition that the legislature chose to use for 631.95. So what I'm struggling with, and I see you're struggling with it as well, in order to accept your argument, I feel as if the court would almost have to graft onto 968.075 language that isn't there. And it's in 813, but it's not in 968 or 631.
Your Honor, don't you believe that the actions of a physical damage to the property that are aimed at the person and engenders the fear under the sub 4 of 968.075 1A was put there for that purpose? That is, you don't have to physically hit the person or shove them down the stairs or throw them out a window or attack them, but if you do anything, any physical act which would engender fear of physical harm would be sufficient. And that is my point. I think they could very well assume that arson, which is directed at the person's home and possessions, there's only one thing left after your home and your possessions, and that's your body. And that is to me a clear threat. As I said in my brief, the Klansmen in the South in the 60s learned that lesson well. We'll burn your houses and your churches, and next it'll be you. And that's the terror that is intended by such an act. And I think it fits within 968.071A.
So, counsel, yeah. You're reading sub 4 of physical act. If the legislature had wanted that to be infliction of physical pain, injury, or illness on the person, that's already covered by 1. 2 is intentional impairment of physical condition. 3 is sexual assault, essentially. 4 is the physical act. And your argument is that such a physical act could be arson, that arson may cause a person to reasonably fear imminent engagement in actually their body being harmed.
Absolutely.
Is it an objective or a subjective test?
Well, it uses the word reasonably fear and the word may. I believe that was the reasonable person standard to be applied. It is not a subjective standard where a woman comes into court and says, well, he threw a lamp on the floor and I was afraid he would next throw it at me and hurt me. I don't think subjective, because it can go both ways. I don't think the court or the statute implied subjective. It is an objective court reasonable person, to use that definition, not to get lost in what do we mean by objective or subjective. Reasonable person. Would a reasonable person in the eyes of the finder of fact fear for their bodily safety as a result of that physical act? And that's the question presented by the statute. And a physical act is arson.
Justice Karofsky, did you want to ask a question?
No, actually, both Justice Bradley and Justice Dale had asked what I was going to ask. Thank you.
Okay.
Counsel, in your response just now, you left out the word may. And of course, that's conditional. It doesn't mean that they, tell me what you think in the context of 968.075 sub 4, 1A sub 4, what import is the word may?
I think it reinforces the reasonable person standard to be applied. It's the may. It doesn't require that this person basically have a mini trial and convince the court that she in particular felt this things on that date. It is the reasonable person may, and the court is therefore allowed to inject its reasonable person standard. I don't believe it's subjective because I think that would become too unwieldy.
Counsel, one of the odd sort of factual pieces in this case is that your client didn't know about the fire immediately after it occurred, that it was set by her husband. Was there anything in the record that tells us when she found out that this fire had occurred and that he caused it?
Well, I don't think she ever knew whether he actually caused it, and she was afraid to ask him. During the examination under oath that was done by the insurance company's lawyer, he asked her, did you ever ask your husband that he start the fire? And she said, no. And that lawyer stopped short because he knew the next answer. Why didn't you? The answer was because he would have harmed or killed me. That is the fact. And she would not confront him and could not out of fear of reaction.
Well, one of the, I guess, interesting things here too, the Court of Appeals looked at the record here and said that there was just an absence of evidence put forward of this sort of situation of the potential for imminent physical harm. You know, that he had not done anything to physically harm her in the past. It's sort of odd that the house gets burned down, but she doesn't know about it. And then she's supposed to respond with, I have, you know, imminent fear of harm here, physical harm. How would you respond to the Court of Appeals saying that the evidence, what you just said, what was going on in her mind, the Court of Appeals says that's not in the record. How would you respond to that?
First of all, the position of the case was 2 weeks before going to a jury. And throughout the entire case, the position of the insurance company was that she was a co-conspirator and that she was guilty of fraud. 2 weeks before trial, when really pressed motions in limine, they conceded that she was an innocent spouse and stipulated that fact in all respects. So now, for the first time, we could satisfy the requirements of 631.95.2f. She is now stipulated to be innocent. He is incarcerated at the time. And now, for the first time, we can proceed and perhaps move forward. But the judge invites us on summary judgment and discovery is closed. So you're kind of handcuffed at that point. When you first become eligible or right to assert the elements of 631.95.2, which is her innocence by stipulation, now we can talk about it. But discovery's closed, and I was going to deal with it at trial. Quite frankly, the whole issue of her being a victim and not a co-conspirator was going to be the subject of a two-week trial.
Isn't that your burden? I mean, in summary judgment, your burden is to bring forward evidence to satisfy, to create a disputed issue of fact or to survive summary judgment. I mean, don't you have at least some burden of production of evidence to create some genuine issue of fact?
Well, as I say, there's a timing issue here when you can't even really legitimately make the motion until the other side concedes that you are an innocent and not a co-conspirator. That's the mechanics of it. But in reality, I continue to maintain that the destruction of that house was an act, and all of its contents, every picture, everything that would be precious to her, that was a physical act of domestic abuse. And every article that I've ever written about women's rights and the abuse of women would qualify that. Now, that's, I guess, for us to decide now was that a physical act sufficient? But there is no question that that act occurred, and that is the act.
Just one more question, Justice Kravke, and then I'm happy to turn it over to you. So I take it from your position here is that you're not necessarily disagreeing with the Court of Appeals characterization of the record regarding the absence of evidence there, but you're indicating that you didn't feel like you had an opportunity, you were going to present it later on. Is that a fair summary?
Well, yes, but you're ignoring, again, the fact that, as did the Court of Appeals, the act of arson is an act of a physical act that destroyed the property, as is intended by 631.95.2F to be not allowed to be enforced, and it was such an act. And it was unquestionably such an act. It was an adjudicated act by him. Intentional destruction by fire of her home. And yes, she was in Europe at the time. And Justice, she also waited 10 days to come home because she was afraid to come home. She was afraid. She didn't get a plane and come right back. She, like most women who are afraid of injury, they try to escape that and not have a confrontation. And that's what she did.
Counsel, we don't even need to get to, and I hear what you're saying about the fears, and I was in a domestic violence court for 3.5 years, so I get it. But isn't it true when your responses before, I think it was to Justice, maybe Ann Walsh Bradley's questions, isn't it true that we're talking about this more objective test, whether that physical act may cause the person to reasonably fear imminent engagement? So do you really have to put in evidence of what she personally thought or felt?
I don't think so.
And does it matter when does it say in there somehow what the timing is of fearing imminent engagement? At the moment she finds out that, even if it's at trial, that she finds out that he's the one that burned down her house, and once she knows it and she's aware of it, is that enough to be fearful? or to believe it's the case, even if it's not proven at trial that she thought that he did it? I mean, is there a timing element on the imminent fear that comes into play with domestic violence?
This is a provision that is restricting the insurance companies from enforcing a property loss clause, an exclusion for intentional destruction. And so if it is an act that would reasonably generate fear of bodily harm in the victim owner of the property, they can't enforce this property loss exclusion. That's how I would string it together. And to answer your question, whenever she had that fear could be dependent on when she finds out certain facts. But is it such an intentional act that would generate fear in a reasonable person, then they can't enforce the property loss exclusion.
Mr. Owens, we're talking about this as if all he did was light her house on fire and burn it to the ground with all of her belongings in it. But there is actually in the record other evidence of his abuse. Is there not? I mean, in the record, we know that she wants to get a divorce after he is convicted of sexual assault, and he will not allow her to get a divorce, which is required under her religion. So he uses male privilege. There's also evidence in the record in her deposition that he had lost over $17,000 gambling one year that she didn't know about. So he uses economic abuse. He uses intimidation, obviously, by destroying her property. He uses denial by first refusing to admit that he caused, that he was responsible for the arson. So isn't that, if someone needs to look to the record to find if there is evidence of domestic abuse in addition to the arson, isn't that in the record right now?
Yes, it is. And as I mentioned in the brief, yes, those are all the background information that is in her mind that's going to lead her to reasonably fear, as would be the statutory basis if we're going to strictly utilize 968. Those facts are in the record, correct?
Or what if a reasonable person having that as their background, would they then fear the imminency of harm?
And that's, at a minimum, we have a fact issue for a trier of fact. If the arson itself isn't res ipsa loquitur, as I mentioned in the brief, then at a minimum, we have a jury issue.
Thank you.
I wanted to track through the one last thing about, and I know I have only a few minutes left. If a person gets divorced, I should say a judgment of legal separation, they cannot remarry until they get a judgment of divorce. They have to get a judgment of divorce. And it's a provision that does not conflict. You can get a judgment of legal separation. You just can't remarry. Like Henry VIII, and that's the classic example. He needed an heir. He needed an annulment of that marriage to Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of the king and queen of Spain. He couldn't chop her head off. He couldn't get rid of her. It would cause war. So he needed an annulment. He couldn't get an annulment from the Pope, so he broke from England and from Rome, and he set himself up as the philosopher king and granted himself the annulment to allow him to marry again. So to marry again in our laws, you must have a judgment of divorce and you must wait 6 months. And you can convert any judgment of legal separation by simply filing unilaterally a motion to convert your judgment of legal separation to a judgment of divorce with a single sheet of paper. It's mandatory for the court, and wait 6 months. You get your judgment and you get your 6 months. Now you can remarry. That doesn't mean that you weren't divorced on the day the judge banged the gavel, and I must stop.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Attorney Fredericks, are you ready to begin?
Yes, Justice.
Please do.
May it please the court and counsel, Mr. Owens. My name is Jim Fredericks, and with me is Allison Kleiner, sitting 6 feet away and masked, properly socially distanced. Good morning. We represent Kemper, who's the plaintiff in this action. There is no evidence in the record whatsoever of domestic abuse. None. Mr. Owens had years, as in several, to put any evidence he wanted into the record. There were multiple motions. He moved for summary judgment in the fall of 2018. He maintained all along that his client was innocent. He could have put something in the record at any time before any hearing conducted by the trial court.
Mr. Fredericks, what would you need to see in order for you to be convinced that there was domestic abuse? Because I got to tell you, I certainly hope that in 2021, that what we are not going to require are for women to show up in court with black eyes. So what is it that you would need to see here to be convinced that there was domestic abuse? Because when I read this, I find it all over this record. What am I missing? Or what are you missing?
I don't know, Justice, but an affidavit to answer your question, saying she feared for her safety, saying she suffered from abuse, giving specific examples.
And are you aware, Mr. Fredericks, that when women report abuse or they try to leave domestic abuse relationships, that they are at the greatest danger for being killed? Are you aware of that?
I have heard that, yes, Justice.
Yeah, it's true. Actually, you're 6 times more likely to be killed when you try to leave a domestic relationship. In this record, he uses his male privilege by not allowing her to divorce, even though she wants to. He clearly uses economic abuse. He minimizes. He destroys all of her property. Let me ask it this way. If you knew that he slashed her car tires, would you think that would be domestic abuse?
It might be.
Okay. It might be. What if he threatened to destroy, her most precious belonging? Say her most precious belonging is an expensive bike that she owns. What if he threatened to destroy that bike? Would that be domestic abuse?
It'd be, yes, again.
If he threatened to hit her, would that be domestic abuse?
Absolutely.
If he threatened arson, if he threatened to burn down everything she had, would that be domestic abuse?
It could be.
When would it not be?
When you're on the other side of the world, gone, when there is no evidence of any threat of domestic abuse and your house is burned down. That doesn't mean she's a victim of domestic abuse, Justice. And I guess we disagree on that. Well, I don't see anything.
So let's look at the statute. 968.075 defines domestic abuse as a physical act that may cause the other person reasonably to fear the imminent engagement of physical harm. So I guess your argument is that if someone burns down someone else's house, that the victim, it would be unreasonable for that person to then fear their own physical harm when the source of their safety, their house, and everything in it is what's burned to the ground. Is that your argument?
Yes, that it'd be Mr. Islami burned the house down for the money. He didn't burn the house down. You're assuming, Justice, with due respect, that he burned the house down to cause her to fear for herself.
Mr. Frederick, you are getting to what is in his mind, his motive and his intent, and you spend some time in your brief on pages 37 and 38 talking about that. There is nothing in 968.075. There is nothing in the 631 statute that talks about what's in his mind. That is not there. So you're saying that what Mr. Owens didn't do was attribute any motive. That's not necessary. It is whether or not it is whether or not the other person reasonably feared the imminent engagement of physical harm.
Right. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that she did. Nothing. There's nothing in the record to suggest that he was exercising male privilege. There's nothing in the record.
Not allowing her to divorce him isn't exercising male privilege.
She didn't want a divorce.
Okay. Mr. Frederick, can I take us in a different direction just a little bit? It's the same direction, but a little bit different. I want to get us out of the whole factual dispute because I want to get you to what four means. A physical act that may cause the other person reasonably to fear imminent engagement. So why does anybody have to put in evidence of anything? The question that is arson a physical act that may cause another person to reasonably fear imminent engagement in 1, 2, or 3? So isn't arson? Doesn't arson fall in that category? I mean, it can be domestic violence in a situation such as this one of a spouse against another spouse. And so why do we have to show facts?
Because there has to be something in the record as to why the arson was done. And the reason is because then anytime there's an arson, anytime his home is burned down, there's never going to be any coverage defenses.
Okay, Mr. Fredericks, let's take a step back. We got to look at F. We're looking at the statute. We're doing this on statutory construction. The person has to have burned down someone's house, and it has to be a domestic abuse. So it has to fall within the section. So it has to be a spouse or a former spouse or someone who they resided with or have children with. And they have to be criminally prosecuted for it. I mean, the whole purpose of this was to protect domestic violence victims, right? This isn't anybody that just burned somebody's house down. This is very narrow. This is domestic violence, right?
But there has to be some evidence of domestic abuse, and there is none in this record. And simply a husband or a spouse burning another spouse's house down would make all of this just totally irrelevant. There'd be no exclusions, no conditions. You get covered. That's it. Because automatically, what I'm hearing justice suggests to me is anytime there's an arson, this statute's going to apply because by law, an arson means domestic abuse. And I disagree. Kemper disagrees.
Counsel, go ahead.
I think it's on page one of one of the amicus briefs, the Lodge brief. They state this: Kemper's position on Ismet's claim for insurance coverage seems to be that under its policy, Ismet was entitled to full coverage for her loss when Yidbi criminally set her home ablaze, but that she lost the right to any coverage whatsoever when Yidbi lied about his involvement in the deed months later. Is that a correct statement of your position?
Judge, Kemper's position is that the condition was violated, the fraud condition, if you will, or concealment condition, and therefore, because it was, coverage is unambiguously excluded to ISMET, yes.
So another way of answering my question is, yes, that description is your position. There would have been full coverage, but for the lie, and then because of the fraud exception, there's no coverage.
Correct, Justice.
That seems a bit absurd to me. And that was the argument advanced in the brief, that we have no problem, Kemper says, with full coverage, regardless if they're married, regardless if they're separated, regardless of any of the other facts, we have no problem with full coverage. The reason you don't get full coverage is because he lied. That's your position. It just seems at the least incongruous, and at the most, it does seem a bit absurd.
Your Honor, there will be portions in any kind of a case, whether it's an auto case, a home insurance case, a commercial dispute involving commercial coverage, there may be provisions in a policy that say that there's coverage or there's an exclusion or there isn't an exclusion, and there's other provisions in it that say that there isn't. So the mere fact that one part of a policy may deny coverage to insured and another part would allow the coverage that's the case in every case, probably, in any kind of an insurance coverage dispute.
A little exaggeration for emphasis, but let me go to my next concern. Is under the statute, is 968.0754.1A4, does that set forth a subjective or an objective standard?
I think it's subjective, Your Honor. And that's why I think we need something in the record, and there isn't, to establish what it was she was thinking and feeling.
Now, just a moment. Let me interject and say, if it is objective, do you agree that she does not need to have an affidavit saying she personally feared for her safety, as you just indicated?
No, I do not agree. There has to be something in the record that indicates that she was subject to domestic abuse of some kind. And there was plenty of opportunity to put that into the record. This did not come up, Your Honor. This did not come up until we filed a brief on January 4, 2019 at the request of Judge Domina. Judge Domina on December 18 or December 19, 2018. Asked the courts for supplemental briefing on a confined issue. And in the process of doing that, we raised the point in our brief of January 4, 2019, that the legislature, if it wanted to provide innocent spouses coverage, no matter what, could have done so when they were enacting this statute. After that, after our citation to the statute meaning 631.95. That's when Mr. Owens raised for the first time, right before the judge's final determination that there was no coverage.
Counsel, I want to stay on the objective versus the subjective. Are you indicating that there had to be an affidavit demonstrating that the arson reasonably led her to fear such harm?
There had to be an affidavit that, yes, that arson, she felt that the arson subjected her to some harm, or she feared for her imminent engagement. I'm looking at the words of the statute, or she had fear of some kind for her safety. Something in the record. And there was plenty of time to put that into the record.
What do you do with the word reasonably? I mean, to my ear, when you're talking about, you find the word reasonable or reasonably, it of course raises the specter, if you will, of the reasonable person standard. I mean, I think virtually all the time when I see that in a statute, it is the reasonable person standard, which is an objective standard, which we always decide de novo. It's a matter of law. This is summary judgment, right? Genuine issue of material facts. Seems to me that the standard, though, is objective. Otherwise, I'm not familiar with any statute that uses the word reasonable or reasonably that doesn't seemingly invoke the reasonable person standard. Can you cite any to me?
No, and I think that's a fair point. And to me, that is all the more reason why we need something in the record from her. And then if there is something in the record, Attorney Owens could have argued whether or not that's reasonable or not.
Reasonable,
we're not even to that.
Hold it. Reasonable, sure. For what? Reasonable for her or
Right. Reasonable
for the objective reasonable person?
Reasonable for her.
Hmm.
Yes.
Go ahead, Justice Hagedorn.
Sorry. Normally, counsel, when we have objective tests, we do look at what a reasonable person would think under the circumstances to distinguish that from what they actually felt, right? So it would seem to me that what the statute, by invoking an objective test here, which I agree with Justice Bradley that it does, isn't questioning whether she actually felt, but whether she might reasonably have felt fear. But isn't it also true that under all of our objective tests, we have to look at all the facts and circumstances of the case? And isn't that why we would want evidence? I mean, in the criminal context, for example, you would query whether there was reasonable suspicion. You would look at what actually occurred in that case, need evidence of it to determine whether a reasonable law enforcement officer would, for example, reasonably suspect that a crime may be taking place. So is it your view that it has to be a subjective test, or that the objective test might also work but still need some evidence?
Either way, we need evidence. I still think it's a subjective test, Your Honor. But we need something.
Go ahead. I thought you were done. No, go ahead and finish, please.
Either way, we need something in the record was the only thing I wanted to add. Thank you.
I just want to go back to talking about the word imminent. And in your brief, I think I characterized it correctly, but if I didn't, please correct me. I read your brief as saying that you read imminent to mean basically immediate. And I just want to point your attention to 968.075 sub 2M. So it's in the same statute where we see imminent. It's just in a different section. And 968.075 sub 2M, the legislature actually uses the word immediate. They say immediate release prohibited. They're talking about that police officers should not just release domestic violence suspects, that they need to be arrested. So given that, we see the word immediate in 968.075, and that we have imminent in the part of the statute that we're looking at. How do we define imminent, knowing that the legislature could have used immediate and they didn't use immediate in the part of the statute that we're looking at?
Well, that's a great question. And I think earlier, maybe it was in the when Mr. Owens was presenting, there was talk about, well, maybe it was a drafting error or a Scrivener's error in it. And maybe that's what happened here. Maybe they just, you know, they were using immediate or imminent. That's certainly possible. I can't speak to that. But imminent, I think the common sense meaning imminent is now or very soon. And to me, that's the same thing as immediate.
So you're saying, counsel, that immediate and imminent mean the same thing?
Yes.
And the legislature made a specific choice. We have to assume, we can't assume Scrivener's errors, right?
Well,
and we just can't. We have to assume that the legislature uses its words and chooses its words. So they chose immediate in one part and they chose imminent in another. And you want to say that they mean the same thing?
Yes. I mean, a dictionary definition of imminent is, as requiring a temporal element threatening to occur immediately or happening soon. So I think they're synonymous with each other. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I just want to follow up. This is a question I asked your opposing counsel, but I guess it wasn't entirely clear. On the record, when did she find out? What was the time frame between the fire and when she became aware, to the extent it's clear in the record, that he had caused this fire?
She found out, she received word several hours later about the fire. And at that time, too, it'd be her husband or her spouse was hospitalized for an unrelated reason. In other words, he was not in the home when it was, he didn't suffer injury from the arson itself. And she was informed of that as well. After that, the record's a little fuzzy, but she claims and testified that she never asked her husband what happened or why he did it or anything along that nature. And so she didn't even know that he's the one that burned the house down. She didn't even think it. It wasn't even in her mind, and she didn't ask him about it, and it never occurred to her.
You made a statement earlier in argument that his motivation was for the money, the insurance money. Is there anything in the record that supports that assertion?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Could you point us to at least some of that, maybe?
Sure, sure. Let me just turn to the page here one moment. Both Mr. and Mrs. Islami had quite a few financial issues. They had tried to sell their home to resolve that before the fire. They owned a restaurant, which was underwater, that's my word, in terms of debt, and had problems there to the tune of millions. They tried to alleviate those debts. The restaurant was called Around the Lakes. And in addition, they had some type of an interest in a casino in Macedonia, which incidentally is where Mrs. Islami was when this fire occurred. Mr. Islami had invested over $2 million in that casino in Macedonia. So we had offered as a witness a certified public accountant who was going to say that Mrs. Islami, neither Mr. Islami nor Mrs. Islami had sufficient income to cover their monthly expenses.
Doesn't the record show that the house was only in her name, that he, by burning it down, he's not going to get any proceeds, right? I mean, didn't they divide up? I get that you're saying they're spouses, and I get that legally that's the case, but they're legally separated, and they had a agreement as to who got what, and the house is hers, right?
The house is titled in her name. That's correct.
So she's the only one, so he's not going to get any proceeds from the house.
Well, I don't know what he's thinking, Your Honor. If maybe he thought he was going to get something out of it. I don't know.
Okay, even though he's aware of the agreement, the legal separation? I mean,
they're married.
Makes sense to me.
They are married. The only reason, and this is in the record, they got a legal separation in 1998 is to transfer debts.
Isn't it also in the record that she put an affidavit in that she asked for that because she learned of his sexual assault conviction? I mean, we can't take part of the record and not the other part, right? We can't just look at the part that helps one side or the other. We got to look at the whole record. And doesn't the record show her affidavit is that she asked for a divorce because she learned that he was convicted of sexual assault. And I think actually he spent time, he violated his probation and actually went to prison while they were married. And that's when I'm not sure exactly on the timing, but it sounds like that was a part of it, right?
Yeah, after the lawsuit, she submitted an affidavit, that's correct. But before the lawsuit and examinations under oath, she said she only obtained the legal separation because they were concerned about creditors or other people coming after Joe's assets. Joe is the same as Idby.
Where is that in the record that says that's the only reason? I did not see that.
And so further, please. She admitted that the record citations...
Yeah,
Your
if you
Honor.
Can point that out to me, I'll be happy to look at that. Thank you.
Okay, we will find that hopefully The record is 129, Your Honor, is the EUO.
And you're saying it says that that's the only reason that they...
She was concerned about creditors or other people coming after, she called him Joe's assets. And she admitted that through the legal separation, she was hoping to avoid her assets exposed to the creditors or judgments that Joe had.
Didn't she make that statement before he was arrested? And then after he was arrested, she knew that she would be safe. Then she talked about that she wanted the legal separation because he had been convicted for stalking and sexual assault and violence towards women, which is another way of saying she was able to say those things once she knew that she was going to be safe from him.
Well, that's an assumption you can make, but I don't know that, and I don't think the court knows that either, to be honest.
Counsel, let's get back to what you've been arguing and talking about some kind of financial considerations and the financial difficulties. And I was sitting here wondering, what does that have to do with your denial of coverage? I asked you earlier if the premise on page one of the WAJ brief was correct. And you indicated, yes, you would have paid. Forget about the casino in Macedonia or wherever it is, or forget about their debts. You would have paid. You would have covered this loss, but for his lying. Is that still correct? You said that 5 minutes ago. Is that still correct?
Yes. I think we got down a different path, Judge.
Okay. So that he may have had financial difficulties or they may, which might have been a motive for burning down the house. I mean, that has nothing to do with Kemper denying coverage. I think we have established that the reason they denied coverage, but for his lying, you would have given coverage to this. Is that correct?
Right. Right. The violation of the concealment and fraud condition, if you will, Judge. Yes. I see I have the sign for five more minutes.
I have a question I'd like to ask you, and tell me if it's relevant to your argument or the opposing party's argument. There is a document signed by both of the wife and her spouse under the document. They're signed both as an insured, and it's a proof of loss claim against Kemper, and it's dated September the 7th, and this fire occurred June 10th, correct? And my question to you is there anything in the record to show that she knew he was a cause of the fire before the September 7th proof of loss was filed?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. If I may, I have a few more minutes. I'll try best to summarize. This is a case involving an interpretation of an insurance contract, and it always has been. We tried to get to the nub of the issue before trial by proposing several stipulations, which is record 165. Many of those stipulations, or the one we've obviously talked a lot about, is the concealment and fraud one. There are several. Everybody agreed that IDB committed or conspired to commit the arson, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in addition, it indicates at the bottom of that document on page two, it is the intent of the parties to this stipulation that the court may proceed to decide as a matter of law whether there is coverage for the subject fire loss provided to Ismet Islami under the homeowner's insurance policy issued to Ismet Islami by Kemper Independent Insurance Company, period. Signed by me and signed by Attorney Owens. He and I both agreed there were no issues of fact. Our clients agreed there were no issues of fact. This was ready to be decided by the court as a matter of law. The language, the condition at issue is unambiguous. I know we haven't had a chance to talk about that at all, But I know Mr. Owens disagrees, but we think our brief, as well as the brief of the amicus brief of the Wisconsin Assurance Alliance, sets forth what we think is a clear reading of that policy provision. We believe Idby is an insured under the policy, that he held himself out as a spouse. Ismet held him out as her spouse to the insurance company. They signed the necessary application, so forth. They insured a couple of different cars. They're both listed as being spouses on the policy. They held themselves out to the federal government and the state government by way of the filing of their taxes as being married. They clearly are spouses, both under terms of the policy and I think under terms of Chapter 767 of our Wisconsin statutes. I disagree with Mr. Owens. I don't think 766 applies. The marital property statute, the applicable statute is 767. Thank you. I'm probably nearing the end. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Attorney Owens, are you ready to proceed with rebuttal?
I am, Your Honor.
Please do.
Your Honor, honors, I want to point out one thing from the get-go. If Yibbi Islami is not the spouse of Ismet, he is not an insured. And all of the exclusions only apply in the policy if he
but
is
they
a
both
insured.
Signed a statement. They both signed a statement under oath in September after the June fire where they both listed themselves as insured. And that's why I asked opposing counsel about it. That's in the record. So it's a different position you're taking now than you took before.
No, that is not true, Your Honor. If you carefully look at the sworn statement of proof of loss, which is on R207, of the appendix of the respondent's brief, it does not identify whether or not Mr. Islami is signing as an insured or a subscriber. It says the loss did not originate by any act, design, or procurement of the insured or the subscriber. Now, this is a single-page form provided in Illinois to them by an agent of Kemper. It's singular for owner, by the way. It says owner, not owners, twice. And she is the sole named insured on the policy. Now, the only document that indicates that they are actually married, and I do think the court needs to look at this, actually, it's in the appellant's appendix at page 223.
Why do you care that we worry about whether they're married or not? Because even if they're not, and we determine that the domestic abuse statute applies, that's the end of the story. They don't have to be married. And you're riding most of your hopes on the fact that we will do just that, correct?
I would say I believe that the marital property law is the correct answer because there's no evidence that she ever told anyone that she was married. She's a co-owner of the property.
Counsel, what is the difference? You want us to say they have to pay her because this was evidence of domestic abuse, correct?
Well, you don't
need to be a spouse or ever married to have that statute apply. So I don't get why you're so stuck on the Marital Property Act, frankly.
Because if he's not an insured, nothing that he said under this fraud or concealment matters. If he's not an insured, he signed as an insured,
and she signed right along with him. So at that moment, they both seemed to think he was an insured.
Well, he can assume that he's an insured. That's not her conceding that he is.
Okay. All right. Okay. I understand why you're going there now. Thank you.
Yeah. I think that it's as important. I also really mean, I would like the court to specifically look at page 223 and see the only place that indicates that she was married is in the tiniest print on the automobile rider, which has a separate premium. And it's their statement that she's married. She's told them in the examination under oath that she had gotten a judgment of legal separation. We just heard Attorney Samus talk about that. He said that she got a judgment of legal separation. She didn't say I got a judgment of divorce. She didn't say I'm married. They've determined that a judgment of legal separation is not a divorce and therefore they are still married. That's a legal decision that they've
How did they file their taxes, since you want to go down this route? How did they file their taxes with the federal government?
The fact is, Your Honor, my client's position, although she was never deposed on that, was that she did not sign any tax returns and would not know what a tax return is. Probably her brother or her husband, ex-husband, signed for her. If we got into the trial, the signature lines are completely different on all these returns. She owned the restaurant with her brother, not her husband, or this would be. The tax returns, there were joint tax returns signed, but her signature does not appear to be accurate in them. And that was going to be a trial issue, and it was disputed. So this idea that they filed joint tax returns it's made up. There's no evidence that that's true. They have a document from an accountant who says, I got these documents and they've never been authenticated as her tax return, or that she ever saw them, or that she signed it, or that that's her signature. So she did not necessarily at all hold herself out as married. And she has a sixth grade education from Macedonia and stated in her affidavit she would not know what a tax return was if you put it in front of her. So that's the facts, real facts about this woman. So she did not hold herself out as married to them. She did, and their tax returns would be whoever gets homeowners insurance based on tax returns. It has nothing to do with the risk. That's all I got. Okay. I got to stop.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a very, very interesting case with a lot of wrinkles that keep moving around, at least from my perspective. But thank you. You both did a very good job, and the briefs were helpful as well. We are going to adjourn now. The court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. We are.